session number 4299, reel 4.
Sergeant Hayes, reel 4. How did your troops react to the news that they were going to go to East Africa?
They were very pleased, in actuality, because we had had an intensive training period of 7 or 8 months from the outbreak of war, and in which they had started to feel as though they were never going to see any warfare at all. And when eventually we went to embark overseas, there was a feeling of relief amongst them. And the ones that was taken off due to sickness or reasons of this nature were most disappointed and pleaded to go, but of course it was only the people who was physically fit that were allowed to go.
How much were they told about what was happening, and how much did they understand, do you think?
Oh, they understood quite well. I mean, we used to tell them everything with them, and particularly at this time, we was going through a very bad phase with the withdrawal at Dunkirk, and we explained the facts to the soldiers, and they was really set to have a go at these Germans if only they could get across to see them. And of course we was explaining that in the first instance they wouldn't be fighting Germans, but we'd be fighting African soldiers of the different national armies. Like the Italians had quite a lot of native troops and this, you see. And
was this the first time that they'd come across the idea that there were other Africans like themselves employed by other white
men?
Yes,
yeah. They didn't realise that at first.
Yes. And how did they react to that?
Oh, they thought themselves so superior that, you know, it wouldn't be worth worrying about. They wanted to fight the European soldiers, which they did, of course. Mm. And
how did you tell them about this? Did you have to use
propaganda? Pardon?
Did you use very simple propaganda?
No, we used to have training sessions, and when was on board ship, especially going down to South Africa, we used to have to divide the ship space so that we could do training on the deck with one lot, and the other lot would probably have them somewhere else giving them lectures and moral lectures, and also about keeping themselves fit and what was the country like that was going to, what could they expect there, you know. And by the time we got down to Durban, they had a real intensive training of what the country was going to be like, which they're going to. And it came to no surprise to them when they got there, you know. For instance, we was telling them that when the daytime it was very, very hot, the same as what it was in their own country, but at night it was very, very cold, which they hadn't experienced, you know, and that there was snow and mountains, and well, what's snow? So you had to explain to them and get a bowl of flour and mix it all up and splint it down and say, it's like that, but it's wet, you know. And and eventually they did see snow. They realised what we'd been trying to tell them was a load of nonsense. It wasn't like that at all. Then when we got to Durban, we got off the ship there and we waited.
Could I ask what sort of ship it was?
Oh, yes, it was a very luxurious liner. It was the Orion. It was on the Australian one, you know, and 29,000 tons of it. And they was treated just exactly the same as what the British people were, you know, proper linen beds and everything. And there was someone had mentioned to the captain that this wasn't necessary for native troops, and he was highly indignant, and he said that as far as he was concerned, the native troops was just as important to him as what the British ones were, and they get the same treatment, and they did. And they, you know, was looked after very, very well. Of course, when we got to Durban, the British soldiers coming from India to go back to Europe embarked on the Orion, and we went on the little Indian boats, which was quite vastly different. And we went up to East Africa and went to Mombasa, first of all, where we then split up into units. And we went up to a place called Nanyuki, which was about 90 miles north of Nairobi. There was within reach of Mount Kenya, and the fresh air and the first thing of the morning was something that these people had never been accustomed to see snow. And as the day grew on, it got gradually warmer and warmer until they had an intense heat in the afternoon, you know. The terrain there was much different to the Gold Coast, and we had quite a new form of training of going in thick vegetation, you know, and forest land and places like that. Then shortly after we'd been there, we'd been probably a month, and went up then to the northern frontier of Kenya, to a place called Wajir. This was a Bojes place, a little white fort, and we had a company of the 1st Gold Coast in the fort, and the remaining companies and the battalions was stretched out in tactical formation, bivouacked. But the funny thing was that there was a, this particular time, the Italian Air Force used to come over in one of their bombers regularly in the morning and in the evening and drop a stick of bombs, supposedly on this fort. And they never seemed to hit it. And the Gold Coast soldiers thought this was lovely. They thought, absolutely crazy, these men keep coming out and dropping bombs and hitting nothing. And then suddenly someone came along from divisional headquarters and looked with horror at this white fort and said, camouflage it. So everybody set to and camouflage it, brown splashes of paint and green splashes, and the white was eliminated. And that next morning the Italians came over and dropped a stick of bomb straight on the parade ground in the middle of the fort. And the soldiers thought that was really funny.
Were they at all frightened by the planes? This must have been the first.
No, they didn't show any fear at all. As a matter of fact, they was so inquisitive that when one of the planes was shot down once, South African pilot shot this bomber down, and as it was coming crashing to earth, the soldiers started running towards it, and of course we was very angry about this because they could have been seriously injured when it blew up, as when it did hit the ground and blew up. Fortunately, none of our people had got to it, but it was a good lesson for them. And we expressed our anger to them about doing this silly thing, and ever more after that, they was quite trained. They didn't chase these bombers.
Was it a courage born of ignorance, as it were, that caused them to rush after the plane and not...
No, I think it was inquisitiveness more than anything. They obviously never seen a bomber before, and they was really inquisitive as to what it looked like when it came down, you know. It blew up before they got there, fortunately.
They would have seen aeroplanes before, would they not?
Oh, yes. Yeah, but they hadn't seen a close distance a fighting plane, you know. I mean, if they'd seen the aeroplane there, normally it would be a civilian plane, as there was no Air Force planes in West Africa at that particular time. It came later.
So, on the eve of action, were you confident in your troops?
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes, we told them exactly what they was going to face, you know. We said, well, not only will you be facing the white soldiers, but they'll also have native soldiers as well. And we don't know what the reaction of these native soldiers will be, but we know what the reaction of the white soldiers will be. And that is that they'll be probably more frightened of meeting you than what you were meeting them. And this, of course, was proved at the Battle of El Wak, where the Italians ran away. They didn't face the Gold Coast, they just ran. And this give the Gold Coast a rather, shall I say, a glorified idea of their own importance, which come unstuck later on when we fought at Mogadishu. There was a more severe strength there, and they stood the ground.
And what happened to your troops?
Oh, well, they had to fight either.
But they didn't turn tail?
Oh, no, they never turned tail in the Gold Coast. They was marvellous fighters, and they were the cream of the British West African Frontier Force. And they thought so, and there was no doubt about it, they were. I mean, they was far, far more intelligent than the other troops, and they had more initiative.
What sort of contact were they coming into at this time with other African units, say between El Wak and Mogadishu?
Well, we had about 3 months before from one battle before we got into the other, and then it was a continuous running fight, really, right up to Somaliland, and right up into Ethiopia.
How much action were you seeing on the way?
Well, quite considerable, yes. Yeah. And of course, we were tied up then. At that particular time, we became tied up with the South African division, you see, and fighting alongside with the white soldiers. They thought that was great fun.
How did the white soldiers react to it?
Yes, they liked it. Yeah.
Was there ever any fears about what's known as bloodlust, that the soldiers would go out of control during action?
Well, no, I don't think so. No, I think that the early days of training that they'd had instilled sufficient discipline in them to know. I mean, because this was proved by firepower training. I mean, if you said fire five rounds, that's all they did fire was five rounds, and they waited for the next order, you know. But there was none of this death for glory boy stuff of getting their matches out and cutting people's heads off. They never got that way at all. No.
Were they getting any news from home?
Yes, we had quite a good welfare service. We were getting welfare letters from West Africa and telling them what news from the villages and this, that, and the other, you know.
Who ran these welfare letters?
Well, the regiment back in, you know, the base units, the regiment. And they used to be flown out and come up to with the rations and things of that nature. Sometimes it was a bit delayed, and you know, you have to explain to them that, well, don't worry about it, things will be all right, and we'll find out what is happening. We'd send off a wireless, you see. Well, we had our own troops who was trained in wireless, the intelligent ones, And they knew that we weren't telling lies, that we were sending these messages for them, you know. And they were quite happy. We never had many welfare breakdowns at all.
So what would happen? The wives and families of the soldiers would come along to an office and...
Well, they'd come along, yes, to the... Yeah, and they'd get the pay and things like that that was left in the allowances, you know. And the officer would tell them all the news, what he knew, you know. And they'd say, oh, well, yeah, well, such and such a soldier's wife had a baby, you know, and that had come over and we told them, you know.
Did the system work the other way around, that the soldiers had a welfare letter which they could send back home?
Oh, yes, we used to send regularly news like that, yeah. Yeah.
Well,
you see, and then at that particular time, we started getting into... Well, it was coming up to corps status, really. We passed the divisional status. And we had Church of Scotland ministers and Catholic ministers and Church of England, all enlisted as army chaplains. And they used to come around and chat away to the boys, and they'd tell the priest or whatever he was what they wanted him to do, you know. And that was quite a good way.
I think you said earlier that there was a certain amount of missionary activity in terms of actually getting converts.
Oh, yes, there was, yeah.
What,
but
can you give some estimate of the proportion of...
No, I can't really, but they used to seem as though they vied with each other when we was in rest areas. Stu got the biggest congregation. Whether they bribed them or not, I don't know. But, I mean, quite candidly, they was quite prepared to go to the service for which they got the best perks from. And this could have been a big influence. Well, to what extent, I don't know.
Well, what sort of perks would they be?
Oh, well, I mean, they'd probably get free tickets to concerts and things like that that were going on, or they might be given free razor blades or letter writing paper, anything like that, you know, small things. It's an enticement to come to church.
What were the rest camps you referred to?
Well, there was really just back out of the lines, you know. You'd probably get 100 going back down to Nairobi, for instance. Or they might even go to one of the coastal areas. So
how often would this happen?
Well, not very often. It was taken in strict rotation, and they'd probably get it about once every 3 or 4 months. But normally they'd be there to do the leave a company or something of that nature, put them on coastal escort duties and things of that nature.
So
they weren't mollycoddled. They had to get accustomed to the country they was serving in.
What sort of contact were you making with villagers who would pass on the way?
Very little. Mm. As a matter of fact, we discouraged any communication with these villages because there was so much rampant disease at the time, and especially with native troops, we didn't want them getting associated with the native women. As you can realise, I mean, you start losing casualties from health reasons as well as from battle reasons, it's not going to be too good. So, you know, we had to be really, really strict about this. And there again, that's where the African NCOs came in and played a great part. Mm. We had very few cases of where they had to be sent back out the line for misbehaviour or anything like that. Very few.
What was the ambulance service like?
Very good, yes. Yeah. Mm. We had It was a proper ambulance unit, and proper doctors and trained staff and everything. Oh yeah, the ambulance was very good. Same as the field engineers, they was good in the water companies.
Yeah. And the supplies in general, did they get through
clockwork? Yeah. Well, of course, at that particular time, the South African Army was feeding the British Army, or the Colonial Army. It was only after the fighting was finished in East Africa that we came in contact with the British rationing system. And the South Africans was feeding us all the time.
How well?
What were you eating? Very good, yeah.
Well, the Gold Coast Regiment got as far as Addis, I think.
Oh, yeah.
What happened then?
Well, it was pulled back then, and they went to in training and went out to India for the Burma campaign.
And what did you do?
I left them there and I went back down to the base camp in Nairobi, and I transferred to the 2nd King's African Rifle Corps, and I was commissioned then with them, and they was being trained at that particular time to finish off the Ethiopian campaign, which they did. They went to the last battle up there in Gondar. They took a very active part in the 2nd KR, and the Nigerians had also pulled out. Then we had the Kenya Regiment and Uganda Regiment, 4th KR, the 1st, 2nd, and 2nd, 2nd. It was about 5 African battalions at Uganda.
What was your impression of these troops? How did they differ from the ones that you were used to?
They didn't stand up physically or militarily in any shape or form with the West African troops. This is not a case of sour grapes of any reason, you know. Having served with both of them, I can quite definitely say that the West African troops was far, far superior. And
how did this manifest itself exactly?
Principally, I think the fact that there was a more proud nation in the East Africans. A lot of the East Africans would been under British influence and more or less treated as though they were second-rate citizens, you see, by the farmers and people who'd settled, the colonial settlers in East Africa. And this attitude had obviously been instilled into them, and it showed militarily in accepting responsibility. The British NCOs had to play a more decisive part in keeping discipline with the East Africans than what they ever had to do with the West Africans.
What were your duties at the period? You were
I was quartermaster then, yeah. I was responsible for getting fed and clothed and ammunition, everything, you know, normal quartermaster duties.
Were there ever any problems with supplies?
Oh, occasionally, yes.
What sort of thing?
Well, we did try and give them fresh meat every day, and occasionally, in which part of the country you got to, possibly you couldn't always do this. And I remember one incident where they went out on a route march one morning, and going along the road they came across a dead camel on the side of the road. And I didn't realise this, but on the way back this camel had mysteriously disappeared. And when we sounded up for the rations, we'd killed a couple of bullocks, And they saw this fresh meat and they swore black and blue that this was the camel that the mysterious had disappeared. I said, nobody'd eat it. And I went on to the colonel and I said, well, look, I said, there's nothing we can do about it, colonel. I said, but they won't have it. I said, what are we going to do, you know? And it was a great difficulty. We managed to get somebody along who could speak more or less into the imagination of these people and tell them that what they was doing in actual fact was imagined that it had happened, and in actual fact it hadn't. And someone had gone out and eventually got the skull of this thing. Whether it was the same camel or not, I never knew, but anyway, it seemed to end the sort of argument, and reluctantly they accepted the meat. But they always swore that I was the man who'd given back a camel to eat.
He transferred then to the South African Ordnance Corps.
Yes, that's right. This was prior to my coming back to England, this one. I had done a continuous overseas service, and at that time they decided to introduce a scheme whereby people with long service in colonies could go back to England. And I was on this list, and I went back to England. But before I went back, when I got my commission, they said you had to select a British regiment in which you would be commissioning, and except you couldn't be commissioning the Guards or in the 60th Rifles, as these were special regiments. And I took a dim view of this, because having served in the 60th as a boy and what had been all my service with them, I went along and told the Brigadier I didn't like the idea of this and I wanted to be commissioned in my own regiment. And he said, well, we'll see what we can do for you. Anyway, the Colonel Commandant of the 60th Rifles, having been approached, decided it wasn't likely that I would ever serve with the 60th in the position as a commissioned officer, decided I would be commissioned in the 9th King's Royal Life Corps, which at that time didn't exist. And I became the first boy to enlist in the 60th, become commissioned into the 60th, and into a battalion that wasn't formed. So I have a unique position.
Thank you very much.